Guanuda. Yo guano de yo guanuda. Gayuani he hayokyo he. Gayuani he hayokyo he. Gayuani he hayokyo he. Gayuani he hayokyo he. Yo guano de he yo guanuda. Gayuani he hayokyo he, Gayuani he hayokyo he, Gayuani he hayokyo he. Yo guano de he yo ho guanuda.
And again, I want to welcome my guest, Chief Nathan Perro of the Kawasak Traditional Tribe of the Sovereign Abenaki Nation. Welcome.
Hi.
Would you want to just introduce yourself a little bit more, please, and tell our listeners where you're from and where your people are from?
Yeah, good afternoon. I grew up in the town of Thetford, down in the lower east corner of Orange County. Through the teachings of my aunts and uncles and grandparents, they kept the spirit of our tribe alive. My father was chief of the tribe from 1946 to 1983 when he passed away from the nasty belt of cancer. Before that was Uncle George. And then my great-grandmother, Clarissa, and then her father before her, Jean Gianio. So being chief has been in our family a long time, and I'm proud to carry on that tradition to help our tribe go forward. And we're working hard to see if we can win state recognition through the Native American Commission.
I see, yeah.
So?
Yeah, that's a lot of work to get together all that genealogy and the process of applying for recognition from the state.
Yes, it is. My co-chief, Paul, and I put the package together, and we're both high school educated, so we did our very best. They've come back, the commission came back to us, said we need to beef up four different areas, and we're in the process of doing that, and we'll turn it back into them this fall, and then we'll go to the state house for their questions and answers. So
yeah, so you talked about your family and growing up. You've had a Native identity then your whole life. You knew who you were as an Abenaki person. I was wondering if you may want to share a little bit more about that.
Well, we knew who we were, and through the 50s, that's when this eugenics project really kicked into our family. Many terrible things had happened. My father called the tribe together and set us all down, us children up front, and he was very stern and hard that bad things would happen to us if we said that we were Indian. Mm-hmm. And we didn't quite understand when you're, you know, preteen, you have no idea what bad things are. But Dad was very forceful. He laid it right out, and we had to go underground. Uh-huh. And then when I became in my late teens, I found out that some of our family members had been chemically sterilized. And that's what Dad had talked about when bad things were going to happen to us. And it was very different to grow up having to be quiet about who we were, but we still continued on. We still had many gatherings around the state of Vermont and New Hampshire. Dad was very instrumental in bringing a lot of the tribes that are in existence today, getting them to organize and come back out again. But stay underground. And yeah, it was quite a learning experience. The military, I went in 69, and it was kind of hard. It was good to meet other people from other tribes around the United States.
Wow.
And so then now I was able to start relating a little bit more about.
Yeah, yeah. So tell our listeners a little bit more about you. Your father was chief, and you say he called in the tribe. Is there a today now? You talk about the tribal council, so you have a little bit of a governance to the tribe, that you have your own tribal council.
Yes, our tribe is set up. The council are the ones that set forth what the tribe is going to do.
Uh-huh.
I am basically a spokesperson for the tribe. I do have a little more persuasion for trying to get some of my things through, but we have all worked very hard together. That part, and then we listen to our elders. The elders are the ones who will come back to us and say, yes, you can do this. No, you need to change this and do this, this, and this. So right now we're working on a project of having day camps and week-long camp this coming summer, where we'll have everybody from whoever wants to come and learn.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't matter if they're native or not. If they want to come and learn what we've got to teach, from making baskets right on through, and my specialty is making the Beniki bow.
Oh.
And arrows, everything made right out of the woods.
Yeah.
So these are just things that we want to keep alive.
Mm-hmm.
And the sad thing of it is when we lose an elder, we lose so much knowledge.
Yeah.
And in today's society, I am able to start writing a lot of these things down and recording a lot. But we've lost my grandparents, all their knowledge. We just heard what they had to say. They couldn't read or write. My father's generation, most of them, if they made it to eighth grade, that was quite high. My generation, some of us graduated from high school. And then the next generation, this after I think three of them have gone to college. So we don't have the education that's out there to bring us up to the standards of the rest of the world, but we're slowly working away at it, and each generation will get more and more. And
yeah.
So.
Well, you talk about your elders and gathering with them, and they kind of oversee. And you did mention that things were passed down orally. So is there storytelling that happens that your elders share, or is there language that's being passed on?
Well, your opening song with Jesse.
Yeah.
Jesse... He's in partnership with Elie Jobert. Elie's mother was from Odinac, very fluent in the language. Elie is very fluent, and Jesse is. Elie and Jesse come to our tribe 4 to 5 times a year to start teaching our young ones the language.
Uh-huh.
The young ones pick it up so much quicker and easier. If I come out of a weekend session with a phrase or two more words, I'm real good about that.
Yeah,
I'm happy.
Yeah.
So,
I love the way. And for our listeners, I was playing from a CD called Wobenaki Songs. It's put out by GoodMindRecords.com. You can go to the website. And Jesse Bowman Brujak actually was a student here at Goddard College, and began researching about the Abenaki language. And this is, I'm talking probably in the 80s, or late 80s, 90s. And he found, and I'll try to play this later today, on the CD he does give acknowledgments. And he found a lot of, in his research at the Dartmouth Library. He's been in Canada and Ottawa to do this research. And it's fascinating to me how the songs get passed down and how it's so easy to learn maybe the language through doing the songs and sharing. And I'm wondering, is that happening with you? Are you learning the language through learning some of the songs?
Yes. A lot of the phrases there that I used in the songs are repetitive.
Yeah.
So by repeating it over and over and over,
right.
you start to get it in. And now you start saying, okay, this word means this.
Yeah.
And a lot of times, one word is a whole phrase.
Right.
If you break it down into English, you know, I mean, whole things. So it's a great way to learn. And the children pick up on it so quick.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. It's fun, too, to have, you know, the music. You know, you talk about a phrase, and we've been talking recently about how language in so many in indigenous languages are different than English, in that a lot of times it is about that movement. It is about that relationship that we have with the tree, with the animal, and of course with Mother Earth. And I was wondering if you might want to speak to the relationship that you as an indigenous person has with Mother Earth.
I grew up hunting and harvesting animals for the family to eat. When I was 7 years old, I was able to purchase my first .22. And my story is that I got real good at the shooting the rifle, and my father instilled on us that when you're going to harvest an animal, do it just as quick and as humanely as possible. And so I went out and I had harvested a chipmunk. Being 7 years old, I thought that was a great feat. And when Father got home from his work, I told him about it, and it was after dark, and he said, well, great, where is it? I said, well, it's still in the woods. He goes, take a flashlight, go get it. And so I did, not knowing what was going on. And when I got back to the house, Dad showed me that we take the heart out. The heart goes back to Mother Earth as paying homage, because everything comes from Mother Earth. We come from Mother Earth. We're going back there. And it is a round and round cycle. So he taught me, he showed me how to skin it, how to prepare it, and we took it in, and Mom cooked it. And this is just a little small chipmunk, maybe an ounce or so, but we all had part of it. And that was the beginning of our teachings, that if we want something, we take it, but we give it back. If we don't need it, leave it be. The only obsession that we had on killing something was flies and mosquitoes. So, but other than that, it didn't matter if it was a snake or a spider or whatever the animal was. If we wasn't going to eat it, it needs to live.
Yeah.
So, that was a great... great thing. And I pass that on to all the children that I take out into the woods now and teach them.
Yeah.
And it's the same way with plants. Why do we have so many plants that we bring into the house just to throw them out? We only need to take what we absolutely need to survive.
Yeah. I think it's really important, too, that to understand that relationship that you are giving back, that you don't take without giving back. Could you speak to that a little bit?
I really don't know how to put this into words. It's just something I do all the time. Even if we just go into the composting, whatever we use, those little pieces that we don't, needs to go back to the earth. I have animals that when we have corn, I take the husk from the corn and it goes to the cow. And the cows eat it. So this is always being recycled round and round. My wife gets a little upset when the deer come down and eat out of the garden. It's no problem to me, because if we haven't harvested that vegetable by now, it's time for them to have it. Mm-hmm. So it's, and maybe this fall I may harvest one of those animals to enjoy. 2 weeks ago, we had an Abenaki Heritage Day in White River Junction, down at Lyman Point. And the Fish and Game Department called me at 11 o'clock at night and said, "We have a moose that's been hit by an automobile. Would you like it?" And I said, "Yes." So I went and picked this moose up, and the first thing that I did is I put my hands on this animal, and I gave a prayer to the Creator that this animal had given its life so that we could eat. And we took this animal back, and I processed it, and we used everything that we possibly could use off this young moose. And then everybody that was at the Heritage Day just loved the way I cooked it over an open fire with no seasonings, and all the animals out there had their own great, unique taste.
It was a beautiful song. Do you want to tell us about that?
This song was from the Clan of the Hawk. Clan of the Hawk are located up in Evansville. You've probably heard about the Evansville Trading Post and things. This is run by one of the members of the tribe. And the chief has worked very hard. Way back. He got going because, as I said earlier, my father went all over around the state of Vermont and New Hampshire to get tribes up, and he met with Ralph, and that's when Ralph got, all right, started pulling people together. And 10 years ago, the Nohegan, they're also out of the Northeast Kingdom, they were a member of the tribe, but they just didn't like the way things were going, the politics or whatever, so they separated out and started their own tribe. This has been going on for ever and ever. Most of us speak Algonquin, and the Algonquin go from the Virginias north through Canada, from the Great Lakes through the Maritimes in Canada.
Yeah.
So we've all... The songs are basically the same. The words may change just a very little bit from dialects and things, but most of these songs that we hear are, you know, you can hear them anywhere in the United States, you know, in the northern part. So
you called it a moose call, this past song that we just played.
Yeah, that was, he was blowing through a moose call, which is made out of birch bark. It sort of looks like a megaphone, but by blowing through it, you can sound like a cow moose.
Oh.
And in October, when their mating season is on, you make the cow call, and when the bull, he'll come either charging through the woods to find that female, or he takes his time and walks in and goes, I've played this game before.
For our listeners, my guest today is Chief Nathan Perreault. He is with the Calisuk Traditional Tribe of the Sovereign Abenaki Nation. He's joining us here in the air studio today for, just an introduction to for you all to realize that there are many tribes of Abenaki here. Some are unrecognized, some are recognized, whether you want to call it status or non-status, but there is a network. There is a kind of a web that has happened for many, many years. And Chief Perreault has told us about his father traveling around the state and gathering up these kind of connections. So I want to move on to a little bit about what your tribe is doing today and some of the exciting work with the land, going back to the land, and also the camps that you have planned for next summer.
Well, very good. We're still in the process of trying to bring all the information together. For those of you who have never heard of the Eugenics Project that happened in the state of Vermont, and it was used in other states to take care of their unwanted. And here in the state of Vermont, the Indians were classified as not needed. We were a problem. So this has made a lot of people, a lot of grandparents, not tell their grandchildren who they were. They wanted to save them. They didn't want them to go through the ridicule of being either chemically sterilized or going out as families were separated and sent all around the state. So a lot of the knowledge has been lost. So we are in the process of trying to bring everybody back together. I have information that I share. Other members in the tribe come together and share what information has been handed down to them. So we've got to reconnect and bring it together. And one of the things we plan to do is this coming summer that we're going to have day camps and week and maybe a week-long camp where we can bring, it doesn't matter if the children are native or non-native, anybody that wants to learn what we have to teach, from basket making to what's edible in the woods to how to cook it and prepare it. And the specialty that I have is, well, I can survive in the woods. That's no problem. But I can make the Abenaki bow, along with how to make the arrows and put the fletchings and things on. This was taught to me by my grandfather. And with my first bow I made at the age of 12, I harvested my first whitetail. Being able to utilize what Mother Nature has given us to use is what we're looking for. And hopefully we can pass this knowledge on to the younger children, or maybe there's the older children. I'm still learning, and I'm 64. So, well, yeah, it's an everyday learning lesson. And and anybody that's in the tribe that knows something, that wants to teach somebody else, we want them to come in.
Can you tell us a little bit more about how you come together as a tribe these days? I saw on your website that in the wintertime you do a gathering where you do the snake games, and could you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Maybe you heard from your parents when you were younger, watch out for the snow snake.
Yeah.
And you never really understood what it was. But the snow snake is a game that was done when the snow was on the ground. you take a log, it's about 5-6 feet long and about 3 inches in diameter, and drag this through the snow, which would create a long trough.
Yeah.
And everybody would make their snakes, anywhere from 3 feet to 7 feet long. And they're usually round, or sometimes they're a little flattened on the bottom. And some are decorated up really, really well, and with jewels and feathers and things. And you would start at the beginning and slide this with your hand down this trough. Uh-huh. And whoever went the furthest would win that round.
Yeah.
And it was played pretty much like we did with marbles. Whoever would go the furthest would win all the snakes of that round. So you could end up with quite a few snakes if you had some really good ones that would go a long distance. So we've brought this tradition back. I take my log and my snakes to the schools, and I have the school children come out and try this.
Yeah.
And it's a great way to get the children outdoors.
Right.
And it doesn't cost any batteries.
No batteries.
So, and it's just a great time, and you will cheer and yell. When we invite everybody in the state that wants to come and participate from all the other tribes. 2 years ago, the Elnu, they're out of the southern part of Vermont. They took away the 4 quarts of syrup that was the grand prize.
Oh, you know,
so
okay.
each of the ones, and so they come up with some really good fast snakes. So
and they're all carved out of wood usually, the snakes.
All out of wood. That's the way it has to be.
Yeah.
So some are just plain as can be, and others are just decorated really up. So,
And would this tradition be from a lot of the nations and tribes in the Northeast? Would do this kind of game?
Yes, all of us throughout the northern tiers. I don't know if it was done in the West. That's a good question. Something for me to find out about.
Yeah,
if it was done out there, but that was just something to pass the winter away.
Right.
You know, you got to get outside. Right. If you sit inside and say, oh, what a long, nasty winter, and you just go downhill from there. You got to get outside on the good days and even on the bad days.
Yeah.
Go for a walk in the forest when it's lightly snowing, and you will find peace and tranquility.
Yeah. Good advice. You know, our listeners are, they have been responding to my show called Moccasin Tracks here, and I think that there is a support for not just the traditional ways, but also, you know, some of the political work that's going on and the recognition, and it just seems like there's more of an awareness. I'm wondering if you might want to talk a little bit about creating awareness and how that, you know, moves from you to create a consciousness with people. How would you suggest? I mean, I know you're offering that people can come and see at these different events, the camps that you have. Is there any other ideas you have about how to wake up people to a different kind of awareness for that respect that you have for Mother Earth?
At any time when somebody wishes for me to come and speak to an organization or to a small group, I'm there. More and more people have walked to me and said, we're sorry for what has been done in the past. And a lot of them want to know the real truth that has happened. And every situation is always two sides. And now people want to start listening to the other side. And then more people are wanting to know, what are we going to do with Mother Earth? Here we are, just a little small ball floating around in space, and this is our only home. When we trash our home, it's gone. It's going to take a long, long time to get it back. And I think we're at the point right now where we can save what we have. So one of the things that I'd love to do is go to schools. And if they're first, second, third grade, I will go in and sit right down the floor with them and let them ask the questions. And they always have great questions. They want to know. Usually they've been studying something about the Native Americans. This last year at the Williamstown School, they were teaching Native American, and one of my council members works at that school and said, "You've talked everything about Native Americans, but you said nothing about the Abenaki." Mm-hmm. And the gentleman said, "Well, we didn't really know that there was much going on in the state." So they contacted me, and I said, "I'd be glad to come up." So I brought up all the different things that I had and my big box of furs and bows, arrows, everything that they'd be interested in. And I laid it out, and I talked to the fifth graders. And they had wonderful questions. I answered them all. And they were just really enthused about it. And then the school called me back and said, "Can you come and do an after-school program?" I said, "I'd love to." "What would you like to know about?" And they said, "We'd like to know about gardening. We have a gardening space out here that we give to you." And I said, "I will teach the Three Sisters."
Oh, beautiful.
The Three Sisters has been the mainstay for the Indian tribes all over the Northeast and well, all over America. So, and the Three Sisters is the corn, the bean, and the squash, or pumpkin. And so when I get to this Williamstown school, they said, "All right, where are the tools that we're going to break the soil open with?" And I handed them a set of antlers. And they go, "What are we going to do with this?" I said, "This is how it's done. You take the antler, and you dig apart the soil, then you take your hands and move it. And then we put the fish in the bottom. And the fish is a carp. And the reason we use the carp is the carp and the trout run the brooks at the same time when they spawn in the springtime. So as you are fishing, you're catching both of these species. And if anybody's eating a carp, they will know that the best place for a carp is in the ground. It's much better to eat a trout." So the carp was used, and the carp would go into the ground, and it was covered back up, made into a mound about 2 foot in diameter, roughly that area. And it was left for 2 weeks. Then when it come planting time, we would plant 3 kernels of corn and say the prayers to the north, the south, the east, and the west. And for these winds to bring us the beautiful sunlight, to bring us the rain that we needed to for the crops to grow. And then the following week, and this is done in the north, east, south, and west, the following week, you'd plant 3 kernels of bean. And that would go in the northeast, the northwest, the southeast, southwest quadrants. The following week, you'd plant the 3 seeds of either squash or pumpkin. And the way it works is the corn grows, and then the beans will climb the corn. And the squash and the pumpkin, with their great big leaves, will help keep moisture in the soil. And a lot of times you'll see in pictures or in movies and things of these big fields of corn and stuff. That wasn't done. There's no way people could go through and tear up a whole field. You just tear up what you needed to take up. Like I said before, why do you want to destroy the weeds and the grass for no reason?
Right.
You just make this little area that you need to plant, yeah. And the rest is just left alone. So in the fall and into the winter, the pumpkin or squash was set on end, the top was cut, and then the seeds were pulled out. Some seeds were kept for replanting, some were eaten. Into that, you'd place a little bit of water, place in the corn, place in the beans, and then you put in a heating stone that was kept next to the fire. And these were very hot. You'd pick one up and put it into inside the squash or the pumpkin, and then fill it up with water, and then put the cap back on. leave it 4, 5, 6 hours, take that off, pull out the stone, and you'd eat everything on the inside.
Wow.
And we call that succotash today.
Oh, beautiful.
But this, you know, I've gone to the Lake Maury School, the West Shire School, and now at Williamstown, and I've taught the children how to do this. Hopefully they will carry it on.
Right.
And in each one of these schools, there's always 2 or 3 children that come up to me and go, I'm Indian.
That's beautiful.
Good.
Wow. So, that's really good. And you're planting seeds of consciousness, really, when you do that work. It's really beautiful. I'm talking to Chief Nathan Perreault. He is the chief of the Kawasak Traditional Tribe of the Sovereign Abnaki Nation, and it's really been a delight. We are going to have to wrap it up. So, in closing, what would you like our listeners to know about your people?
The only thing I can say is that if your family has been in the state of Vermont or New Hampshire or Maine or here in the north before the 1800s, there's a good chance you've got Native American in you.
Hmm.
People have been here. We've married into the other societies that have moved in. So, and the other thing that we want from you is proof of genealogy. And my co-chief, Paul, if you give him as much information as possible, he will go back into his records and files, and he will show you what your genealogy is.
Wow.
He did one line on me, and he went back to 1601 of a Huron clan. So, I mean, that was just unbelievable.
Wow.
That these records, most of the records are in Canada.
Yes.
And they've opened up these church books. You know, there's 3 genealogists in Canada that are going through these books, trying to find all these different lines for people. So, if you're interested in genealogy, contact us. Our web page right now is, I don't know, something's happened to it, but it'll be up and running shortly. And it's just kawasukabenaki.com. And that's spelled C-O-W-A-S-U-C-K. The way we spell it is K-O-A-S-E-K. So
kawasukabenaki.com.
Yep.
Thank you so much for coming in today, Chief Nathan Perreault. It's really been a delight talking to you.
My pleasure.